Hashtag psychotherapy unfucked with Mark Fielding.
Hello, welcome to series 4, episode 17, of hashtag psychotherapy unfucked. As you know, I'm Mark Fielding, psychotherapist, relationship counsellor and your host. Today, I have the absolute pleasure to interview Rochelle Craig. Rochelle is an addiction counsellor specialising in working with compulsive and destructive eating behaviours. And with Rochelle's permission, I'm going to read some of the narrative on her LinkedIn profile by way of introduction. Rochelle writes, "I do this work because I want to give something back to the community and to the people who are struggling with addiction. I particularly focus on disordered eating behaviours, including compulsive overeating, restricting and bulimia, because that is what I suffered from for 16 long years between the ages of 15 and 31. I've now had the joy and freedom of being in recovery for nearly 30 years, and I'm grateful to say that my recovery has been longer than when I was suffering. Time has flown, but I'm so grateful to work in this field and share my personal and professional knowledge, expertise, and experience with my clients. I believe I give them skills, education, understanding, empathy, identification, and most importantly, hope. But the great thing about this work is that I'm constantly learning from them too. Binging and compulsively eating did not fill the hole I was trying to fill, like the wonderful people I meet in my work. And that includes my work colleagues as well as my clients. We all share the journey of recovery and we all only have to do it one day at a time. What a privilege." I mean, I wanted to read that, Rochelle, because I thought it was really lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on the show. I always ask our guests to maybe kick off and just talk a little bit around their personal experiences that brought them into the field.
Yeah.
I mean, could okay. We maybe start there?
We can start there, yeah. When I was listening to you reading my my narrative there, and it sounds so much from the heart and the soul, and yeah. Really that is where it comes from. It does not come from my head at all. And it said something about 31 years, or a bit older now. I think it's about 34 years in recovery now. So, it's amazing. Has time flown? Yes and no. You know, I'm really privileged to do this work, and I've been doing it for the last 20-ish years.
Yeah.
So that's a joy to do that, a joy, and also the emotional roller coaster that I recognise in my clients I had in myself, you know. I think the thing about binge eating disorder in particular is that people don't necessarily show extremes physically, and I certainly didn't.
Yeah.
People aren't necessarily emaciated or super obese and bedridden, yeah. Which I wasn't. I was somewhere in the middle, carrying 2.5, maybe extra stone. So I didn't look, for want of a better word, like I had a problem.
Yeah.
It was also over 30 years ago when things and mental health were not spoken about how they are today.
For sure, yeah.
Addiction wasn't in my radar. It wasn't in my life. I didn't come from a family of addicts or alcoholics or anything like that. So I had no concept of compulsive behavior or anything like that at all. What I did have was, growing up in the 70s, I had role models that were twiggy. I know that hasn't changed today. I know there's still very thin role models out there, and the drive to be thin. But that was the world I came into, the 70s. Things were changing, you know. Junk food was coming over, but also extreme dieting and commercial weight loss programs were coming into our country.
Yeah.
So there were mixed messages all the time.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of peer pressure to look thin. And I think I started feeling it, the pressure, in my kind of really puberty, 12 and 13 years old, that pressure to look thin and look good and be attractive. You know, my mother had an eating disorder, And so I didn't realize it at the time, but as we all know, we model ourselves over whoever's taking care of us,
Yeah,
whoever's in our lives,
for
whoever
sure.
influences us. And I was influenced by her, of course. So the everything kicked off going to a diet, I think, a commercial weight loss program at about the age of 13 or 14. And that was my first experience of having to restrict food and count calories. And that was really because my mother wanted me and my sister to be thin. It felt like a good idea at the time. It sounded healthy and coming from a sensible place, to be honest, it was all very new and exciting. So we gave it a go. And honestly, like anybody who has their first drink or their first whatever, I didn't know that for 17 or 18 years, I'd be struggling to control my weight. I had no idea, my weight never, as I say, really went that bad. But what I did find was my obsession with chocolate and sweet things. I wanted to overeat. I wanted to hide the food. I didn't want my mum to know I was having that kind of food, even though some of our greatest moments of sharing, secret, excited sharing, would be chocolate cake and ice cream. Those are the memories I have with my mum sharing that kind of food. But for me, it was about a journey of trying to lose weight, trying to look thin. I worked in the music industry when I left college. It was very, very full of people trying to look good all the
Yeah,
time. I
absolutely.
discovered slimming pills during that time, which were amphetamine based. I discovered diuretics. I went on extreme diets, couldn't maintain it. Extreme exercise, couldn't maintain it. And so the opposite of the extreme would be to turn to the food, to binge, to secretly eat, feel guilty, feel remorse and shame, and then go back to the restricting regime again.
And I guess, I mean, it's a big conversation, but so much pressure then, really, particularly on women, I think, to look a certain way. I mean, that pressure is still the same as far as I can see today. I think it's kind of segued over partly to men as well now. But I guess, I mean, could I ask you just for our listeners who are not familiar with what binge eating disorder is, Michelle, could you say what it is? I mean, what is it?
Yeah, I can. And it has been diagnosed now as a specific disorder. It is in there. There's a huge manual that comes out in America every 5 years called the Diagnostic Service Manual. But it is a huge manual of mental health disorders, and binge eating disorder is listed in there. And it's basically eating an amount of food in a discrete period of time that a normal eater would never ever eat, a huge amount of food in a small period of time, normally within a couple of hours. Some of the other characteristics as well would be that feeling of not wanting, well, wanting to stop and not being able to, that feeling of guilt and remorse afterwards, feeling uncomfortably full, but that also not being enough to stop. And rapid eating and isolation, secret eating. Those are the real typical characteristics, I would say, of binge eating. Those specific ones, particularly that secret eating and feeling uncomfortably full, and that doesn't indicate that you want to stop, because it's actually that physical pain of feeling uncomfortably full. That a person who binges is actually looking for that physical pain so that they don't have to concentrate so much on the emotional or some perhaps psychological distress they're under that has triggered them to eat in the first place. Does that make sense?
It
Yeah.
does. So the because I guess with, and correct me if this is totally wrong, but I guess with when the binge is happening, I mean, I guess there's a strong kind of element of numbing out, really. It's probably fairly automatic, can't stop. And then with the fullness, they focus then, you know, is on the fullness and maybe feeling, I mean, maybe some people maybe, you know, will then maybe, I don't know, vomit or just try and work it off in other ways. But it's to do with emotional regulation, is it? Would you say? Is that often the cause? Yeah. Is that why people do it?
Yeah, I mean, we can call it emotional eating, if you like. Yeah. I mean, why does somebody binge? And also, why do we have compulsive behaviours of any
yeah.
kind? If binging is on food, it could be alcohol, it could be drugs, it could be
For
sex, it
sure.
could be
Yeah.
gambling.
Could be almost anything, really, couldn't it?
It could
Yeah.
be almost anything. And it's interesting because I work with the addiction model as well
Yeah.
as an integrative therapy as well, but I look at it as a addictive compulsive behavior
Yeah.
because it has all the characteristics of any addictive compulsive behaviors. It has that characteristic of wanting to avoid withdrawals no matter what, feeling the urge to eat and not being able to stop.
Yeah.
And also it starts, as I said earlier, just like any other obsessive compulsive behavior, as just a simple coping mechanism that kind of seems to tick the boxes on a stressful day. And for most people, it will just be that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all it will be.
Yeah.
But there is a global statistic, and I don't think it's changed. I don't really look at statistics very much, but I don't think it's changed very much for well over 50 years, that approximately 10% of the global population have a predisposition to compulsive behavior of some
Yeah.
kind.
Yeah.
Now, I know this is going out to lots of people, and someone might jump in and say, no, no, that's not true. But it is a statistics that has been there really since statistics first came around. And this isn't
For
just
sure.
about alcohol or drugs. This is about just a predisposition to
Yeah.
some kind of obsessive compulsive nature.
Yeah. I mean, almost a genetic. I mean, I guess there's probably a genetic component to this. There's nature, there's nurture, you know, it's both. Yeah. And I guess the compulsivity of it. Yeah. I mean, I guess when you describe it, it seems like a real compulsion, you know, irrespective of how much the person, you know, at the other end of the binge might feel guilt and shame and feel really bad, and then maybe lead on to restricting while they're binging. The control they have over it is almost nil, really. I mean, is that kind of how it is for a lot
Yeah,
of people?
and
Yeah.
the denial that they feel in control
Yeah.
can also, because if a person is on that binge restrict cycle,
Yeah.
which is often how it goes, people will experience both ends of the cycle. They'll binge, they'll restrict.
Yeah.
Like I described my journey, you know, I ended up putting on weight, and then I would go on very, very, very extreme diets with
Yeah.
slimming pills and extreme exercise. And I also abused laxatives as well when I
Yeah.
was really deeply ingrained in my eating disorder. So that compensatory behavior
Yeah.
is actually what bulimia is. So my experience of binge eating disorder was binge eating disorder plus compensatory behavior,
Yeah.
which was the laxative and the exercise
Yeah.
to compensate for the binges. So very often you will get that compensatory behavior accompanying
Yeah.
binge eating.
Yeah.
But it's that compulsion. Yeah, Mark, it's such a compulsion. And people don't, I think what happens is there's a need to fill an emptiness.
Yeah.
And again, we can all say we're driven to connect and feel comfortable in nature or with animals, children, or in relationships. We want to connect, we want to feel some kind of link with people.
Yeah, for
And what
sure.
happens is food becomes a very big connection and a very big relationship.
Yeah.
And it mars the person's ability to have healthy relationships. Again,
yeah.
people have relationships, and I'm not saying people don't, and they're not hiding away from people, but eventually the isolation becomes so much. It's like a double life. I led a double life, to be honest, and
yeah.
I work with addictions, and there are two groups of addictions. There are substance addictions and there are behavior addictions.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Substance is obvious, it's substance. So it's crack or heroin or alcohol. Behavior is behavior. And food comes under that, eating and relationships and sex and shopping. And on the behavioral side, you cannot abstain completely from the behavior because it's part of life to have sex and to eat and to be in relationships and to spend money. But what you have to learn is to eliminate the compulsive behavior. And that is the difference between a substance addiction where you abstain from the substance. Of course, there are still behaviors around that, but this second category, right, this behavioral category, which we're talking about today, it's much more complex. And it's very, most people lead respectable lives. They're paying their bills, they're running their homes, they're taking their kids to school, they're working, whatever. And they it's like this double life because it's like a hidden, it can be hidden. It can be hidden
A
much more. I'm
secret.
not saying that alcohol and drugs can't be hidden. They can, and people function to a level of some, but eventually the negative consequences are noticed much more by people
Definitely.
than the food consequences.
I mean, like if someone's an alcoholic, I mean, some people could hide that and they could still function, they'd go to work. But I guess as the disease progressed, it would be harder and harder for them to hide it. They might go into work in the morning after drinking. But with eating, I guess it can be hidden. And just to kind of cycle back to what you said at the start, often people, as you say, with binge eating disorder, they won't be very emaciated. Someone that is really restricting, and perhaps there's somebody who suffers from anorexia nervosa, it will be maybe more obvious if someone is kind of binge eating and they are very big, physically, they're in a much, much larger body, it's obvious. But probably so many people with binge eating disorder, neither of those apply really. So I guess it's easy for them really in a way to keep it secret, which I guess makes it, even worse. And also wanted to pick up on the pattern of kind of eat of binge eating and then restricting. So I guess those two things really, really sit internal. Because I mean, correct me if this is wrong, but if someone's restricting a lot, I guess their need for food is increasing. And so that's going to lead to them wanting to binge, is it? Because physiologically, their body is really needing the food. I'm guessing there's a relation between the two, is there?
After every famine, there's a feast, and that is as old as time. Biologically, that's how we are wired. Every period of famine is followed by a feast. That is just an absolute normal biological and physiological way human beings are.
True.
But of course, it's all become skewed with restrictive dieting that can't be maintained. And then, of course, the individual then can't maintain exactly as you said, Mark. You just cannot maintain that rigidity. It's not natural. It's going against what we are naturally meant to do, which is why the work I do is so important, that food is found comfortable again and relaxed, and there's a healthy relationship with it, and there's no strict criteria around it. It's a very gentle approach to making small changes and building up on.
Let me ask you a bit more about this. I mean, it's going to be different for everyone, because I guess everyone is very individual. But how do you work with someone that comes and perhaps maybe they've had binge eating disorder? How do you tend to work as a therapist with somebody that, presents wanting help?
Because I'm very specific on my website, when people call me, they will be calling generally for food. So I'm not working with somebody who's coming in and then I'm kind of sitting there listening and thinking, oh, I think this person may have a problem with food. Do I approach it? Do I not approach it? Do I say anything? They are actually presenting that to me. So it's in front of me straight away by the very nature of their inquiry and why they've come to me. So already I'm sort of a little advantage. than, let's say, if I was working with someone who came in, presented depression, didn't want to talk about their food, wanted to keep it hidden. So I rarely get that, if at all. So how do I work with them? Well, this is really interesting, isn't it? Because I'm going to go back to the addiction model. How do I work with an alcoholic? You can't work with an alcoholic if they're still drinking. It's really, 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 really difficult. So my model that I work with is an abstinence-based model. So I will work once the alcoholic has got some abstinence around their drinking, and then I can work with them and not the drink. And I've often said to people, please, I want to work with you. Please come back when you're ready to stop drinking. You know, I really want to work with you. Now, that's an interesting one, because sometimes you think if we work on some of the issues that's causing the drinking will stop. But the addiction model tells me I have to deal with the tip of the iceberg first.
I hear
And the
that.
tip of the iceberg are the addictive behaviors.
Absolutely.
Everything else is underneath that will then come out once the individual starts to stop their addictive behaviors. The difference between alcohol and food is I will work with a lot of relapse with food because of the nature of the drug, for want of a better word.
And I
There are a
guess
lot of,
we all eat,
sorry.
don't we? I'm sorry to jump in, but I mean, I guess if you're giving up a substance, we don't need alcohol, but of course we do need food, so it must be much more complex, I would imagine.
It's much more complex. It's a much more shame-based illness. People don't really want to talk about it. They hate their bodies. They hate what they look like. They have very low self-esteem, very low self-worth. Some people I work with have body dysmorphia, where they hate their bodies so much that they would actually cut their body to remove excess skin. And because of this hatred of the self so much in the body, it becomes a type of therapy that is very, I guess I have to swing between compassion and tough love and find a balance between the two.
Yeah, I can really see that. Because you've got to be strict with dealing with a substance, but obviously you work from a position of empathy and compassion. Must be hard to keep the balance sometimes, actually.
It's very hard. And, you know, I have to get to know my clients really well so that I know when I can, you know, push a bit or love a bit. You know, it's that fine balance. But I guess knowing that I've been through a very similar journey to them really helps with that trust
Definitely.
and that connection very, very quickly. I love to see, you know, I love to see people doing well and obviously improving. But, you know, the journey starts when the tip of the iceberg starts to be addressed. And that can take ages. And then what will come out in the session, or other things will come out
Yeah,
meanwhile, because
definitely.
you can't help it. You can't help what people are bringing into therapy. You know, they may have binged all week. I'm not going to not work with what is they're presenting. But every session, I will always say, what can you do differently this week around your food? What can you change? What can you look at? How can you know, look at changing something? It's really important, because that is the tip of the iceberg, and that is the person is there. But if they're binging all the time and the food is always in the way, it's really hard to get to the person, you know.
Absolutely. And
But
again, I guess as you
I'm with
as you I mean as sorry to jump in there, but as you
no.
strip off the top, I mean, you know, every therapy is completely different, of course, but as you take away the addiction, I mean, goodness me, you know, I mean, with some clients, I mean, I'm guessing that lots comes up, trauma, I mean, all sorts of stuff probably that then you can work with. I mean, it's I mean, goodness me, I mean, you must end up with working with all sorts of things. I mean, often people can fall into addiction for, you know, reasons of trauma or, you know, difficult early experiences.
There's always trauma. Now, we can question what does trauma mean, because going through puberty is traumatic, and equally witnessing a murder is traumatic, and losing a family member is traumatic. So, you know, and sexual abuse is traumatic. So we all experience trauma, and again,
Totally.
not everyone, most people find ways of dealing with it. There's been research actually that if a person is very, very well supported immediately after a traumatic episode, so they've got good family or friends or even professional, but certainly family and friends around them, very well supported and are able to talk about it, that the chances of developing any further, anything like sort of PTSD or anything further down the line is highly reduced. It's when an individual has nothing there, so they will find ways of dealing with it themselves.
Absolutely.
The rate obesity is directly linked to childhood sexual trauma. Most people who are carrying extra weight would have experienced some form of childhood trauma, and they will use their weight to protect themselves because
I
it's a
mean,
barrier.
yeah, makes
It's
sense.
protection, and the same with the anorexia from the other end of the scale. They'll maintain that sort of non-sexual weight so that they're not attracted or attractive to somebody else. So there is a lot of trauma in the work, and as I say, it doesn't have to necessarily be that extreme. It's how people deal with trauma. It can be the bullying in the playground.
Totally, yeah, absolutely.
It can be the first day somebody says something nice to someone could be too much for them to be noted. Everybody, it's on a spectrum, isn't it? It's different for everybody,
Definitely.
really.
Yeah, I
But
mean, yeah. So some, I mean, some, you know, two people can experience the same thing, and one person will have get PTSD, and the other person won't. And you know, just, I mean, we're not going to kind of go down the show, but when you talk about bullying, I mean, when I hear bullying, I think trauma. I mean, you know, it's complex trauma, isn't it, often? But it's true what you say. I mean, I think we all experience trauma, really, in one way or another, really. But so, you know, but there are levels of it, and you know, the coping strategies for it are different depending on, you know, our constitution, genetics, you know, and our support systems. I mean, I'm conscious we're kind of running out of time. Goodness me. I mean, it's gone so quick. But I want to ask you a little bit about 12 step. Could you just,
Yeah, I
because I
had
know that's
something in
part
my
of your
mind actually when you were just saying that. I thought, well, I must say this. And then, oh yeah,
go on.
attachment, just very quickly, and this goes back to trauma, doesn't it? And for people who are listening to this who have no idea what that word is I'm talking about, we all get attached to something when we're growing up, our parents, our grandparents, teachers, friends, animals, whatever. And as long as we've got healthy attachments when we're growing up and we feel nurtured and cared for and our needs are being met, and it may not necessarily always be our parents, it may be our grandparents, it may be an aunt,
For sure.
as long as we've got some, we tend to feel, generally feel, well enough in ourselves to understand what it means to have something healthy to meet our needs.
Yeah, definitely.
Everybody with an addictive compulsive nature would have had a poor attachment as a child and would search to attach to something else.
Oh, that's really
And
interesting.
food is the very first thing that people have readily available.
I mean that,
It's just there.
I mean, good. I mean, that makes so sense, so much sense. I mean, I guess if, you know, just a hypothetical, you know, maybe if a child is, you know, in a family system where both parents are preoccupied, they're not, you know, the child is not getting the attention, not really feeling the secure attachment. What is there for the child to attach to? Food.
And what is there that the parent would give the child as well? Out of the goodness of their heart, they will reward them with food. And unfortunately, and I'm not going to get on my soapbox, though I would like to, but in the 70s, and at the moment, interesting enough, there's a program on the telly about supermarkets in the 1970s showing all the food that came over in the 70s, all the fast foods, all the frozen foods, all of that. And they were really convenient. And really convenient for children, and yeah, that's a whole nother subject. But anyway, you asked me about the 12 steps.
I mean, just because I know 12 step has been part of your journey, you know, so can you say a little bit more about 12 step?
So 12 steps is a mutual self-help program that started in the 1930s. by a group of people who wanted to stop drinking.
Yeah.
And they started a group called Alcoholics Anonymous. They wanted to get sober. They didn't know how. In those days, there wasn't very much going on for sobriety at all. You'd had to be locked up or given electric shock treatment or
Yeah.
maybe join the Temperance Society through the church, but there wasn't very much. And a group of people just decided they could manage to be sober with each other easier than on their own.
Yeah.
And so it kind of grew in the 1930s, and they wrote a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they put a program in it following 12 steps to help people learn how to transform themselves, really. Change their way of thinking and behaving, learn how to lead life sober, and
Yeah.
help others in the community. And that was really basically what it was. Without going into masses of detail and going through every single step, which I wouldn't do, but that's basically what it was. Basic, it was a community program for people to be together, helping each other stay sober.
Yeah.
And they happened to have a piece of literature that they could follow to explain to them the best way of doing that, you know, learning about yourself, learning to make changes in yourself, and helping others. And a few other things were in the steps, but the basic thing was connection.
Yeah.
This was the whole thing. And this is what I've spoken about earlier, that people have this need to be connected, and then they connect to food and drink and drugs and sex and whatever. And that's okay if it's well balanced
Yeah.
and it's appropriate. There's nothing wrong with that. But we're talking about when things go to the extreme here,
Yeah. Yeah.
you know, and people get disconnected from life because they are compulsively connected to a behavior or a
Yeah.
substance.
Yeah.
And so, like you said, they become preoccupied and miss what's going on around them terribly. Of course, there is, I'm just going to say, I really need to bring this in, it's really
Yeah,
important.
please do, sir.
There is something called codependency or compulsive helping. And this is when an individual strives to help another person much, much more over and above helping themselves. They will help another person. They will run around. They will be the one that will always be there for someone else over
Yeah.
and above themselves.
Yeah.
And I see this a lot in this particular group of people who are overweight. I see that a lot in people who don't take care of themselves, but they love to take care of another person.
Yeah.
You know, and so I have a lot of that work that I do as well with compulsive eaters, looking at their need to help another before helping themselves. But what's interesting is in the 12-step program, we are told that part of our recovery is, what's the word? We give it away to keep it. So we give away to keep our recovery. We give to others to keep our own recovery. So we have to learn balance there. And a few people in the rooms want to do it, make sure everybody's okay in their recovery
Yeah,
and
but not
forget that
there.
actually we come first
Yeah,
and then we can be there for the next person. It's like we need to put our life jackets on first
so
to stop
true.
ourselves drowning.
Yeah.
Then when we're not drowning, we can put life jacket on the next person and the next person, but we cannot do it if we are drowning ourselves, you know, and that's so important. And I do that work all the time, a lot with people who want to put the needs of others before themselves, particularly this particular client group, you know, particularly I see that come out a lot. So these meetings are about connection, you know, and there are meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous,
Yeah.
Overeaters
Yeah.
Anonymous, and Anorexic and Bulimics Anonymous.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited that they're growing.
It's
Anorexic and
great.
Bulimics Anonymous
Yeah.
has just opened in St Albans in Hertfordshire. It's the first meeting outside of London, which is really exciting because they're very few and far between. And Overeaters Anonymous are a little bit more broad.
Yeah. Billy's, I mean, as you say, I mean, he's fantastic. And I think it's, I don't know, people know about AA. I mean, maybe people know about NA too, but I think often people don't know about, you know, all of the other, like, you know, the things that you've described there, that these 12 steps are available, you know, and 12 step programs, goodness me, they help so many people. I mean, they, you know, they really do. And what you were saying about attachment as well, yeah, I guess in some ways they're detaching from the addiction and then they're attaching to the group. And as you say, there's something about the group dynamic that I think is so powerful, and the mutual support. We kind of almost at time, but I want to ask you, can you say a bit about it, if you don't mind going over 5 minutes or so? I want to hear about your training. I mean, talk a little bit about your training and what you offer and how people can get in touch for it.
So my training that I offer is to it's CPD training for professionals, anybody working in this field, so it can be a dietitian, a
Yeah.
nutrition, through to GPs, counselors, therapists, whatever, anybody who's working around this field. I do it online at the moment, but I will go out to places if I'm invited there. And really what I'm doing is helping people understand anorexia and bulimia
Yeah.
and binge eating disorder, working particularly with obesity, but introducing the model that I work with, the solutions that I believe will help people,
Yeah.
and a little intro to the 12 steps, not a big one, but just to let people know that it's there, that it's something that their clients can use, because the model I work with is one-to-one therapy weekly and joining one of the 12-step groups. That's what I believe works, because peer support to me is one
Yeah.
of the most important things when it comes to compulsive behaviors. Peer support, so very important. So that's kind of my model, and I offer the CPD training to anybody who's interested in learning a little bit more about working in this field.
Yeah.
For some, it's just adding to the toolbox. For others, it's the very first time to learn about this field. But yeah, I do that online, and you can get all the details on my website, which I'm sure you'll hand out.
Yeah, I mean, for our listeners, obviously, as we always do, we'll put all of Rochelle's links onto all our social media sites and along with the podcast. And I have to say, you know, I had the pleasure of kind of doing some of Rochelle's training, you know, recently, and I have to say it was absolutely fantastic. I mean, I said at the time, Rochelle, and I don't say this to flatter you, you know, I think it is probably the best training that I've ever done. I
Oh,
mean, and
thank
I've been
you.
in this field for a long time, you know, but yeah, I mean, I felt that then, I felt that now, I've got so much out of it. So I'd really encourage anyone that, you know, that feels that they want to train with Rochelle, then, you know, certainly to look her up. The final question I ask all of our guests, Rochelle, is what are your go-to coping strategies for sustaining good mental health? What do you do?
I have a dog, and I've always had
Yeah.
dogs, so that's another hour's conversation, the benefits of dogs
Absolutely,
or
yeah. I
pets.
have a dog
Or
too.
pets. I don't want to offend the cats and rabbits and everyone else.
Yeah.
So I've really walk and relaxation, a combination of both, you
Yeah.
know, and the relaxation can be, just those stretching, grounding exercises, breath work, which is really, really fantastic work. Any of those, relaxation and the walking. Those are the two things, and nature. I mean,
Yeah.
I'm looking at the trees now, and the sun's out at the moment. It's lovely, lovely day. I'm going to have a lovely week, actually, of weather.
Oh, good. About
That
time.
bit will probably be edited out, because
No.
when you play this, it'll probably be in the winter with the rain beating down,
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nature, it's nature and pets, and it's some form of relaxation, and keep on track with my food, 3 meals a day,
Yeah.
keep my food regular and good choices, a rainbow of food.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's fantastic. And I just want to say, you know, thank you so much, Rochelle, for coming on the show. You know, again,
Thank you.
we could talk about, I mean, you have so much experience in the air. We could sit here and talk for the next 4 hours, you know. But thank you. It's going to be a really, really fantastic show for our listeners. And it's been really, really great to see you again.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Once again, I'd like to really, really thank Rochelle for coming on the show. Rochelle has so much experience, both as a practitioner working with addictions and working with eating disorders, you know, and also, as she, you know, generously talked about on the show, has a lot of personal experience of recovering from an eating disorder herself. I would encourage anyone that wants to do training in eating disorders to check out our website. We'll have all of Rochelle's links on our social media sites and contact her. And also anyone that's interested in seeing Rochelle one-to-one for addictions or to talk about eating disorders, then, you know, do get in touch. As I said at the end of the show, I did some of her training this year and found it to be absolutely excellent, really. Rochelle talks a lot about 12-step program, and 12-step program has really helped Rochelle in her recovery. And as we said on the show, I think 12-step programs like AA and even NA, I think, are more known and more well-known. But I think, you know, there were lots and lots of groups for binge eating disorder, for cocaine addiction, and as Rochelle was saying, for, you know, anorexia. So if you are interested in joining a 12-step program, just check it out online. If there isn't one in your area, there are 12-step programs going on all over the world that are accessible on Zoom. What a fantastic show. I mean, I could have literally talked for Rochelle for 2 hours, really. It always seems too short, really, but obviously I can't keep our guests for 2 or 3 hours, you know, on the show. We're coming up to maybe the end of season 4 soon. I think we've got probably another 3 or 4 episodes. It's gone really quickly. I mean, I hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed the season. I'm reflecting back and looking at some of the guests we've had on, and wow, it's been a great season. We've had some great guests, and part of the reason I like doing this podcast is because I get to speak to such inspirational people. What I would say, we have a lot of listeners, over 5,000 listens on their audio podcasts. But people often listen and don't subscribe. I think that's fairly common. So if you are listening and you are enjoying the show, please subscribe to the show. It really helps us out in, you know, lots and lots of different ways. And also check out Psychotherapy Unfogged, Mark Fielding, on YouTube. This season, I've started putting some of the shows up, some of the videos up on YouTube. So if you want to see the guests and see the interviews with a visual format, then please check out YouTube and Psychotherapy Unfogged. Got a few episodes coming up, which are going to be really great. Watch this space. And then after I'll go into a production meeting with Joe. We've got some brilliant ideas for season 5. I mean, sometimes I can't believe we're on season 5. It's all gone so quickly. But as always, look after yourselves, look after each other, and look after the planet. And I'll see you on the next episode. Thanks again for listening to the show. If you have been affected by any of the topics on this show or any other of our shows, if you're in the UK, then please reach out. Samaritans can be contacted on 116 123. Now, the GP is also a good source of contact and can be the gateway for, you know, counselling services and other mental health support. Reach out to your mental health support team, mental health first aider, or trusted friend, colleague, or family member. We have a lot of international listeners. So if you're listening from a non-UK country, then please reach out to, you know, your country's healthcare and mental health care providers. And remember, it's okay not to be okay. Hashtag.